The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program. The information provided is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice. Always seek the advice of your personal physician or other qualified healthcare professional before changing your healthcare treatment, diet, or lifestyle.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Ocean Mist Power Hour. I'm your host, Misty Young. And I'm so thankful to have you here today. I'm going to do my best to talk a little slower today. That might freak you out. Already freaking me out. In fact, I just want to ramp it up and go as fast as I normally do. But I want to say to you how much I appreciate that you are here, that you're paying attention, that you're participating with the Ocean Mist Power Hour, where we have a supreme selection of everyday deliciousness in language learning and growth. And what does that mean, really? Well, it means that we try different things. You know, sometimes we talk about nutrition. Sometimes, well, most times we talk about nutrition. It's the passion of passions for me. It's the thing closest to my heart. But sometimes we talk about the shoe bank or how to order organic produce in our area. Or, you know, maybe we'll have a show coming up soon on the Mushroom Festival. It's coming back again in a few weeks. The bottom line is we're interested. I'm personally interested in a lot of different stuff. I love business. I love commerce. I love making money. I think it's freaking fun. It's a blast. I love technology. I love nutrition. I love spirituality. I love meditation. I love the human aura system. I love kids. Well, not really all kids. I don't like bratty kids, but you know, I like kids. I want to help kids. I want to help people. I love life and I feel so thankful. In fact, I just want to take a moment to express the most amazing gratitude to the universe. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you to the stars and the sun and the air, the oxygen that we breathe. Thank you to all these amazing trees around us. Thank you to the ocean. Thank you to the most amazing husband that ever lived, Gary Young. The guy is phenomenal. Thank you to my friends and family and to the listeners here. And I want to thank the, I don't know if it's a quality or a vibration or whatever it is, but I want to thank intelligence and I want to thank curiosity and I want to thank energy. Boom, there's a lot of thanks going on in me today. All right, so we are broadcasting on KCIW 100.7 FM on your radio dial, right out of Brookings Harbor, Oregon, as I like to call it, the gateway of the Great Pacific Northwest. This is about as far west as you can get in the continental U.S. You can actually get a little tiny bit further than right here in the continental U.S., but I didn't say we are as far. I said about as far west. This is the home of daffodils in December, flowers all year round, and the nicest people you'll ever meet. This place, Brookings and Harbor, Oregon, is where the mountains and the redwoods meet the sea. Brookings and Harbor is home to me. Thank you to the entire KCIW sound engineering and production crew and all those folks that hit the ground attending events, recruiting new show talent, recruiting new volunteers to help recording and promoting and all the technical things that happen in the background. You know, you turn on your radio or flip on a podcast and there it is. It's just there, but there's a tremendous amount of work that happens in the background to bring it to you. So thank you to all of those folks. And thank you again to our listeners, to the people who participate here on the Ocean Mist Power Hour. Now, today we are going to talk about health again. You know I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. I'm a nutrition geek, a nutrition nerd. I do hold a nutritional therapist certificate from the Health Sciences Academy and a plant-based nutrition certificate from E. Cornell's T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies. Now, before I resume talking about the thing we talked about last week, which was the lifestyle medicine article in the Permanente Journal, before we start talking about that, I want to just bring your attention to an amazing book. And I want to encourage you, if you're learning anything here, take it to the next level. If you're finding that listening in or checking in on the podcast to the Ocean Mist Power Hour, if you're finding that it's piquing your curiosity at all, get more knowledge. Remember that confused people do nothing. And educated people take a new path. You know, if you want to get something different in life, you have to try something different in life. If you want a new outcome, you have to put some new things in the mix in order to get a new outcome. The book I want to encourage you to read this week is The China Study. It's a revised and expanded edition. It is the most comprehensive study of nutrition ever conducted. It is written by T. Colin Campbell, PhD, and Thomas M. Campbell II, MD. Now that's a father-son duo. It has startling implications for diet, weight loss, and long-term health, and it is blowing my mind. I've had this book for quite a while, and I read the first 9 chapters, which is half the book, in 3 days. It was really fast reading. It's got topics from common cancers and diabetes and obesity and broken hearts and heart disease and lessons from China, turning off cancer. It's, you know, House of Proteins. Oh my gosh, there's so much information in here about protein. And really, if you really want to get your nutrition head on, this is a good book. Again, it's called The China Study. And you'll remember last week I wanted you to read Dr. Dean Ornish's new book, Undo It. These two books together are like they're like a little on-the-job training for you for how to run a better body. And that's really what I'm about. You know, I think sometimes I get going, I rant really hard, I get angry, I get upset, I get super hypered up. I can't help it. I just can't help it. You know, I see people, literally people that I love dearly, that are very close to me, people in my own family that hobble and limp and cry in pain, that are so married to chicken and beef and animal protein. And when it comes down to it, it really is about the animal proteins that are in our bodies that are causing mayhem, wreaking havoc on our bodies. Do you know that as recently as, well, as long ago, this part blows my mind, you know, as long as decades ago, there was already an indication, studies and research that proved, or at least showed the strong correlation between cow's milk protein, which is casein, and type 1 diabetes. Now, we all know that type 2 diabetes comes on later in life, right? They used to call it adult onset diabetes. Well, because so many children are getting this particular adult onset diabetes, they had to change the name of it to type 2 diabetes. Isn't that crazy? Kids get it now. And we already know that type 2 diabetes can not only be addressed and treated, but completely reversed through diet and lifestyle, so nutrition factors. But what information wasn't or isn't well known is that cow's milk protein, casein, is implicated over and over and over again in diabetes, whether it's type 1 or type 2. Now, type 1, usually people say, oh, that person was born with diabetes. Not so. In a lot of those cases, in the vast majority of those cases, the baby gets nursed for not long enough and gets transitioned over to cow's milk. And cow's milk is designed to grow a baby cow from, I don't know, 60 or 100 pounds when they're born to 400 pounds in a very short time. Cow's milk is really not well suited for human beings. Otherwise, maybe we would have cow's milk in our own breasts when we're giving birth to babies. Cow's milk might be the right stuff that's coming out, but no, human breast milk is the right food for babies. So when we put them on cow's milk, all of a sudden these proteins are in their bodies that their sweet little adorable bodies can't handle those proteins. And those proteins look an awful lot like some proteins and some markers in the pancreas where the body goes, hey, there's a protein in here that I don't think is supposed to be here. Attack, attack, attack. And then boom, because it looks so much through a process called molecular mimicry, it looks so much like something that's already in the pancreas, the body attacks that too, kills off the pancreas, no more insulin can be produced by a tiny baby, resulting in type 1 diabetes. That means finger pricking and shots or medications and insulin dosing for the rest of that child's life. I think if parents knew that, they would hesitate to put their kids on cow's milk. And I really want you to be thinking, I want to encourage you to think about changing your language a little bit. Stop saying milk and say cow's milk. Stop saying meat and say, oh, could you even say it? Slaughtered cow. Could you say slaughtered chicken? Could you say slaughtered pork? I mean, just sounds really weird, right? Like, I'm going to go to the store. Usually you go to the store and I'm going to go get some milk and bread and eggs and cheese and some meat or some beef or some burger, right? You might say, I'm going to go get some ground burger, ground beef. What if in your mind you started changing your language? You started changing some language patterns. There was a change in my language pattern a decade or more ago, probably 15 or 16 years ago. I had read something about milk having pus in it, milk, cow's milk having pus in it, and hormones and all kinds of, you know, growth hormones and sex hormones. And I totally grossed out. In fact, I had read a book called Skinny Bitch. That's the name of the book. And can't remember the author's names on that book, but it was pretty much really in your Facebook. And I think it's really the book that kind of made me decide to go plant-based. In that book, when reading about pus in milk, I said, that's just not true. I of course, went to Google and I started looking. And then I talked to a dairy farmer and asked him straight up if there's pus in milk. And he shook his head yes. And then he wouldn't say another word to me. It was very weird and very telling, right? Very weird and very telling. And you can smell milk. I mean, sometimes when you have cow's milk and you open it up, and there have been times when I have opened up a cow's milk container. This is obviously decades ago. Open it up and it just reeks. It's got a bad smell. It smells sour. And you're like, well, but the date on it says it's good for 10 more days. Yes, I'm putting on my voice. Right? Like there went the rant voice. There it showed up. But when I've smelled that in the past, I'm like, wow, that is so gross. Ew, gross, ew. And then when I realized what I was actually smelling was like deceased virus casings and pus, molding up pus or growing pus. I grossed out. So the language change in our family changed from I'm going to the store to get milk to I'm going to the store to get almond milk. And it's been funny because even to this day, well, I mean, I've been on almond milk at least 15, maybe 16 years, long, long time. But even now we're like, okay, I'm going to go to the store. I'm going to get some milk, some breads, whatever the things are. But we always say almond milk. Like, dude, we don't drink anything but almond milk. So we don't have to qualify it anymore. But I'm asking you to qualify it. Like, qualify that you're drinking cow's milk. Notice that. If you're drinking cow's milk, notice it. Pay attention to it. You might have more animal proteins in your body than you realize if you're drinking cow's milk and eating cow milk cheese or goat milk cheese, or if you're eating lambs, slaughtered lambs, or if you're eating slaughtered chickens. Again, it starts in your mind, right? What I'm asking you to do is get a mindset shift, because that's where any and all change has to start. It has to start in your head, in your mind, a mindset. All right, so the China study, great book. I want you to read it. It's not tough reading. The China study is so-called. The whole book is not about China or about Chinese people. It is about a correlation. It's the correlation of cofactors in disease and morbidity. So how people were dying and why they were dying, and then how does that affect your average person in the U.S.? The next chapter I'll read is chapter 10, Wide-Ranging Effects, Bone, Kidney, Eye, and Brain Diseases. Like, wow, this stuff is fascinating. All right, that is your assignment. One other thing that is your assignment. If you like reading books, but maybe you kind of do it, you're like, oh, well, I'll read myself to sleep. So you get a book and you read it till you fall asleep. Is that really supporting your goal of learning, or is that supporting your goal of needing to fall asleep? Maybe you could sit in a reading chair or a thinking chair or a specific place in your home that's designated for your learning and growth. You've heard me say before that my friend John Maxwell says most people are already dead, they just don't know it. What does he mean by that? He means that people are not living their best life. They're not even living a life by design. They're totally on default. Like you wake up, you get out of bed, you take your shower, you brush your teeth, you use the restroom, you go downstairs, you get your coffee, you get yourself ready for work, you go to work, you you go home, you go to Fred's, you get your groceries, you go to bed. Next day, you start over. It's the same exact thing. What's different between life by default, what I just described, and life by design, which is where you start with a mindset that says, I want something more than this. I want something different than this. And remember what we said a few minutes ago, if you want something different in the future, you have to do something different now. So if you have any health issues, then doing something different now could make a real big difference for your future outcome. The cool thing for me is I don't have any health problems. I'm in really robust health, and I'm super thankful for that. I don't take any medications, although you do know my medicine is broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, kale, lettuce, apples, oranges, tomatoes, celery. I mean, I'm a vegetable freak, and I love fruits too. And I want to encourage you that if you would like to have robust health, be thinking about the things you put in your body. Just think about it. Change your mindset. Confused people do nothing. You do not have to be confused. Now, last week, on our last episode, we started by reading, or we didn't start with it, but we shared an article called Lifestyle Medicine, a brief review of its dramatic impact on health and survival. And I am going to read the abstract to you again, because I want to set it up for you, because if you didn't hear it last week, I definitely want to encourage you to go back and listen to that show. So I'm going to read the abstract, and I'm going to skip over the parts that we read last time, which was a lot about inflammation. We'll move into the next section. And let's tell you who wrote this. This is Lifestyle Medicine, a brief review of its dramatic impact on health and survival by Bodai. I'm not sure if this is Balaz I. Bodai, MD, FACS, Therese E. Nakata, star provider, bunch of initials, William Wong, Don Clark, Steve Lawenda. I could go on and on. There's almost two dozen authors on this. And Thomas Campbell happens to be one of them, as does Michael Greger, both of whom I cite regularly and study regularly in my research. The abstract says, by ignoring the root causes of disease and neglecting to prioritize lifestyle measures for prevention, the medical community is placing people at harm. Advanced nations influenced by a Western lifestyle are in the midst of a health crisis, resulting largely from poor lifestyle choices. Epidemiologic, ecologic, and interventional studies have repeatedly indicated that most chronic illnesses, including cardiovascular disease, cancer, and type 2 diabetes, are the result of lifestyles fueled by poor nutrition and physical inactivity. In this article, we describe the practice of lifestyle medicine and its powerful effect on these modern instigators of premature disability and death. We address the economic benefits of prevention-based lifestyle medicine and its effect on our healthcare system, a system on the verge of bankruptcy. We recommend vital changes to a disastrous course. Many deaths and many causes of pain, suffering, and disability could be circumvented if the medical community could effectively implement and share the power of healthy lifestyle choices. We believe that lifestyle medicine should become the primary approach to the management of chronic conditions, and more importantly, their prevention. For future generations, for our own health, and for the Hippocratic Oath we swore to uphold, which is first do no harm, the medical community must take action. It is our hope that the information presented will inspire our colleagues to pursue lifestyle medicine research and incorporate such practices into their daily care of patients. The time to make this change is now. Wow. So then there's a whole introduction that we looked at last week, but what we didn't read last week, and I think this is important, there was a sidebar on emotional resilience. And I really wanted to share this with you because I think it's helpful. A special note on emotional resilience. Emotional resilience is defined as one's ability to respond to an adverse situation and, more importantly, a return to the open and end quote pre-event baseline state of health. Factors impairing or affecting emotional resilience include depression, anxiety, stress, insomnia, and and the presence of comorbidities, namely additional chronic conditions. Depression and anxiety are the most common issues that negatively affect emotional resilience in the Western population. Stress is difficult to measure scientifically because of its omnipresence in everyday life. Depression, in particular, is recognized as a leading cause of disability, forecast to be the second largest contributor to the worldwide burden of disease by 2020. Many of the components of emotional resilience are interrelated, not just among themselves, but also with other medical issues, most notably obesity. The association of obesity and depression has been confirmed by several recent large meta-analysis studies. Depression is a recognized risk factor for the development of cardiovascular disease, CVD, as much as a twofold increase, and serves as a prognostic indicator for poorer outcomes in those already with a diagnosis of CVD. Remember, that's cardiovascular disease. Depression in patients after an acute myocardial infarction has been associated with a threefold increase in mortality. The relationship of depression and CVD is reciprocal. Each increases the risk of the other. Wow, it's like a cycle that feeds itself. Recent investigations have addressed the interrelationship of depression, stress, and CVD. Depression and CVD may result from the cumulative effects of stress on the body. Stress provokes the body's immune system to react by initiating a response to outside irritants, much the same as it does in reaction to bacterial, viral, or chemical intrusions. Wow! At the core of the immune response are white blood cells known as macrophages, resulting in the production of cytokines that aid communication in the immune system, promoting the establishment of a chronic inflammatory state and ongoing endothelial cell damage. Physical activity may decrease such cellular injury. I have to comment. That last statement, that last sentence, it's like eight words. It's incredible. Physical activity may decrease such cellular injury. Wow, that's pretty amazing. So if you're already suffering from cardiovascular disease and depression, a walk is going to help you a lot. You think, oh man, my heart's not strong, I can't do it. Yes, you can. Of course, you want to talk to your doctor and say, Doc, I want to start walking a little bit, you know, and your doc says, okay, cool, let's get you going. You know, can you get a treadmill in your house, or can you get out and walk on the boardwalk, or just park further in the grocery store parking lot? And then when you get in there, buy almond milk. Come on now. Depression and anxiety are also seen at higher levels in patients diagnosed with colorectal and prostate cancer. Depression remains a major health concern, which is often underdiagnosed and therefore undertreated in patients with cancer. Caregivers are increasingly recognizing the importance of screening for and treating depression in patients with breast cancer, but such efforts must be extended to other malignancies. A recent study, the largest to date, addresses the importance of strong social connections. Socially integrated women who practiced a healthier lifestyle, perhaps minimizing their stress levels, had decreased recurrence rates and an increase in overall disease-free survival after a diagnosis of breast cancer. Emotional resilience addresses one's potential to return to a previous normal and is enhanced by an intense support system. Unfortunately, a substantial number of patients face a cancer diagnosis, treatment, and their outcomes alone and without support from their clinicians in the promotion of a healthier lifestyle. Interestingly, the gut microbiome is also involved, or at least has been implicated with emotional resilience, affecting anxiety and depression. Processed foods lead to intestinal permeability, which, as previously described, allows toxins to affect distant organs, including the nervous system. It is recognized that lifestyle alterations, including a healthy diet and the pursuit of exercise, can have a positive impact on emotional resilience as well as cardiovascular health. In addition, the influence of exercise in the treatment of depression and anxiety has been well documented and is not limited to the cancer community. Physical activity decreases symptoms of depression and anxiety, and physical inactivity increases the potential for the development of such conditions. the association of psychological distress in the quality of life in patients with cancer has been noted, as well as an increase in the mortality of those with any malignancy. Now, wrapping up this small little sidebar, which is a special note on emotional resilience, current technology allows for the analysis of the effect of stress on the body at the molecular level. Telomere caplets at the end of each chromosome assist in the regulation of appropriate genetic replication. Each time a cell divides, telomere base pairs shorten, resulting in a lessening of their effective regulation of normal cell replication. Chronic stress and poor health, such as the development of cardiovascular disease and cancer, are linked. Shortening of telomeres has been associated with the onset of malignancies and the process of aging, which itself is a major risk factor for the development of cancer. Chronic stress has been demonstrated to result in such shortening damage of telomeres. Now, I wanted to read this to you because I thought it was important to get the sense of how you could address your own emotional resilience. What did you pick up from that might be helpful for you? Well, people with CVD, cardiovascular disease, or cancer can actually get a higher incidence of depression, right? Well, what can they do to make those things go away? Number one, they can change their diet, of course. They can change what's going into their body. So lifestyle, first of all, what's going into your body. And another lifestyle factor, what you're doing with your body. How much motion you get, how much activity you get. You'd be shocked how many great pieces of home exercise equipment you can find on places like Facebook Marketplace or the Nextdoor app or on Craigslist. I have a lovely suite of exercise equipment in my home, and a lot of it I got for super inexpensive. I got a great elliptical trainer for $90. I got a Pilates machine for $100, and I paid a lot of money for a $15,000 piece of equipment that I found on Amazon. But it was used and it got shipped to me all the way from Michigan. And I paid substantially more for that, but it was worth it in every way for me to have that piece of equipment. My question to you is, what could you divert some spending from to buy a piece of equipment that is gathering dust in someone else's house that would help you in your own home to get more physical activity? I know for me, I'm a bit of a homebody. Like, I get invited to go out and I have things I like to go do. I love to go to yoga. I love to go out and walk in nature and do all that kind of stuff. But really and truly, the ultimate thing I want to do every day, all day, every day is be in my home and work in my garden. And, you know, yes, I love to go for walks. Yes, I love to go to yoga, but I really love being at home. So for me, having home exercise equipment makes a big difference because now I'm home anyway. And my equipment is right there. I can use it. Might that be a way for you to get more physical activity? Did you hear that sentence that said physical activity may decrease such cellular injury? And the injury they were talking about was the ongoing endothelial cell damage. Endothelial cells are the lining cells of your arteries, and they get damaged with poor nutrition. But physical activity can help restore them. Now, last time we were here, we talked about endemic conditions of the Western world. We talked a great deal about inflammation. I think we actually got into talking a little bit about the obesity epidemic, and I'm not sure we got into diabetes. So I think I'm going to start right here at diabetes. So we're going to pick back up on this article. Remember, the article we're reviewing today is from the Permanente Journal, which is a peer-reviewed journal of medical science, social science and medicine, and medical humanities, published by Kaiser Permanente, or it's actually published by the Permanente Press. And this particular article, as I mentioned earlier, is authored by almost 24 medical docs. Look, they're not a bunch of nutrition freaks like me. You know I have a bias toward plant-based, whole food nutrition. You already know that about me. And maybe these docs all have that same bias too. But they're medical doctors. They've been to school. They've gone through science. They've gone through all of these classes. And then they've taken their learning to the next step. These guys are trained at institutions and ladies all over the world. So we're going to talk about cancer next in this same journal, the Permanente Journal, this article on lifestyle medicine, a brief review of its dramatic impact on health and survival. And if you're just joining us on KCIW 100.7 FM on your radio dial, or anywhere in the world at any time of day on the podcast, welcome. This is the Ocean Mist Power Hour. I am your somewhat low-key host today, Misty Young, and I'm glad to have you with me. So this article is a long one. We're just going to move right into the cancer discussion. It seems like everybody is affected in some way by cancer. So despite enormous research efforts and funds expended, cancer continues to be a major cause of death. Each year, 17.5 million cancers are diagnosed, and 8.7 million deaths caused by cancer occur worldwide. In the U.S., 1.6 million Americans receive a diagnosis of cancer, and more than 600,000 deaths are attributed to this disease. In the next few years, the world population will exceed 7.5 billion people, which is expected to drive these figures even higher. The current belief is that most cancers are the result of inherited genetic abnormalities. Yet, 90% of malignancies are rooted in our lifestyle and environmental exposures. Many of these exposures are modifiable. We can avoid tobacco and alcohol, decrease our exposure to ultraviolet light, increase our level of physical activity, and perhaps most importantly, alter our diets. Wow! In the U.S., October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. September is set aside for prostate cancer awareness, and March is dedicated to colorectal cancer awareness. These awareness campaigns are laudable. However, their emphasis on early detection, treatment, and survivorship does not address the more crucial issue that many such cancers can actually be prevented by lifestyle changes. For instance, obesity is a well-recognized risk factor for the development of a large number of malignancies, as well as for cancer recurrence and mortality. In 2016, the U.S. will have more than 14 million persons alive as survivors of cancer. In comparison, in 1971, there were 3 million cancer survivors. By 2020, there will be 20 million people in whom some form of cancer has been diagnosed who are alive and well. More than 75% of all cancer patients currently live beyond 5 years. As such, there is ample time for patients to implement lifestyle changes that may further contribute to their overall disease-free long-term survival. Like, why do we have to wait for someone to come in and sit down at behind a table with a white coat on to say, "Well, Mrs. Jones, I'm sorry to inform you that you have breast cancer." Why do you have to wait? Why is it that we have to wait until we are told you have colon cancer, you have breast cancer, you have prostate cancer, and then all of a sudden all these red flags go up? I mean, even as I'm talking to you, my energy is it's just soaring through the roof. There are goosebumps top and bottom of my body. Why do we have to wait to get that devastating diagnosis that crushes us, crushes our families, devastates entire families before we go, "Oh, maybe I should try something different"? There's that voice. "I'm trying not to do that, but I'm going to do it again. Oh, now I have cancer. I should try something different." Don't do that. Don't wait. You know, my husband went to see a doctor a few years ago, a naturopathic doctor, and we're kind of weird. I'm really weird anyway. I'm very weird. I go to a lot of doctors. It's so strange. I'm kind of doctor shopping right now. I'm not doctor shopping. I'm establishing now with a new doctor that I trust, believe in, I'm excited about. But I go get medical tests because I think it's fun, because I like to have numbers. This is a little personal, but I'm going to tell you anyway. I'm 57. I'll be 58 pretty soon. And somebody asked me the other day, they're like, "Well, you had your colonoscopy, right? I mean, you turned 50, you had a colonoscopy, right?" And I'm like, "No." They're like, "What do you mean you didn't have a colonoscopy?" I'm like, I have very low risk factors for any of that stuff. I don't eat meat. I don't eat cheese. I don't eat dairy of any kind. No eggs, no processed. I mean, I'm like super, super, super clean. And I have tons of regular blood testing done. I go over and beyond. I put my arm out. I always laugh and joke and say, "I've got the best veins you'll ever see." They take out vials and vials and they do all these tests and they always come back. They're like, "Well, you're in just perfect health." I'm like, "Yeah, right? Isn't it awesome?" But I like that. I like knowing my numbers. I like seeing those things. And yes, I did have one of those little poop in a jar things tests and then mail it away, man, that's so embarrassing. So it's a kind of a colon test without it having to be like invasive. So my question to you is, what can you be doing now to not be sitting in front of a doctor, to have a doctor say to you what a doctor said to my husband a few years ago? He said, oh, you're my John Wayne type. Gary walks in and the doc checks him out and he's like, you're looking good, man, but I can tell who you are. He goes, you're the John Wayne type. Everything's fine until it isn't. That's what he said to him. Everything's fine until it isn't. And it's so weird because shortly after that, Gary developed gout and it was bad gout. And Gary, he likes to tell me that the gout, it was in his big toe. He had fallen. He cracked his toe. It was really in pain. He went to the doc. You've heard me talk about this story before. The doc said, I don't think your foot is broken. I don't think your toe is broken. I think you have gout. And Gary was incredulous. He couldn't believe this woman was telling him you have gout. And he was like, oh my God. He goes, I'm telling you, lady, I cracked my toe. I hit it really hard. It's in a bad way. This is not gout. She does the test. She does the x-ray. She comes back. She's like, well, Gary, just like I said, there's no fracture. There's no breakage. There's no nothing. There's no damage. And see this red spot right here, da 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 da. And she put him on a bunch of anti-inflammatories and the gout was cured shortly after. And then he modified his diet in a massive way. And he's, you know, massive. I mean, he made massive changes. Because you know I went plant-based years and years ago, but Gary didn't. And I said to him, I'm like, look, I'm going to cook really great foods here in the house, but I'm not cooking beef for you. I'm not cooking chicken, turkey, sausage, ham, bacon. I won't cook those things. So if you want meat of any kind, you have to prepare it. I won't cook for you. And I'm a good cook. So fortunately for him, I had taught him a few things about cooking and he continued to cook meat for a while. And then when he gave it up completely, he's never had another experience of gout again, not even. I mean, he doesn't eat cheese. He doesn't eat meat. Well, he still does once in a while have some meat and he has to deal with it. But he doesn't have gout anymore. Now, most guys go out and they get put on allopurinol and boom, they can eat meat. They can have steak. They can have cheese. They can have wine and beer and all, you know, shrimp, all the things that are at the top of the list that cause gout. But again, do we have to sit down and be told, oh, you have cancer before we say and take it seriously? Like Gary, you know, you're my John Wayne type. Everything's fine until it isn't. Because for colorectal cancer, back to this article, in 2015, there were 1.7 million cases of colorectal carcinoma with 832,000 deaths worldwide. More than 140,000 people in the U.S. will receive a diagnosis of colorectal carcinoma in 2016, and more than 50,000 will die. Is that you? Is it a family member? Someone you love? Someone you'd love to have around your life for a long, long time? Colorectal cancer is the third most commonly diagnosed non-sex-specific cancer. Less than 20% of colorectal carcinomas have a genetic basis. Let's repeat that. Less than 20% of colorectal carcinomas have a genetic basis. Therefore, most colorectal cancer cases have been linked to environmental exposures, e.g., food-borne mutagens, and chronic intestinal inflammation. Perhaps no malignancy other than colorectal carcinoma demonstrates so dramatically the connection between inflammation and the development of neoplasms. Patients with chronic inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis, and Crohn's disease are at an increased risk of breast cancer development, adding to the ever-growing body of evidence linking chronic inflammation to the progression of cancer. The risk of colorectal cancer developing increases with the duration and extent of inflammatory bowel disease. The microbiome of the gut has also been implicated in the development of sporadic colorectal carcinoma. Risk factors for the development of colorectal cancer include a sedentary lifestyle, obesity, and the dietary components that form the basis of the standard American diet. Large amounts, large consumption of red meats and highly processed foods, and low amounts of fruit, vegetables, legumes, and fiber intake. Wow, I have to read that again because it's one of those things. Remember, this article that I'm sharing with you is authored by 24 doctors. Medical doctors. Here's what they say. Risk factors for the development of colorectal cancer include a sedentary lifestyle, obesity, and the dietary components that form the basis of the standard American diet. Large consumption of red meats and highly processed foods, and low amounts of fruit, vegetables, legumes, and fiber intake. Wow. Low-fiber diets, such as the standard American or westernized diet that promotes inflammation, have been linked to the increased risk and development of colorectal cancer. In addition, patients with colorectal cancers appear to have more comorbidities at the time of diagnosis than patients with other malignancies. For example, patients with diabetes have a 26% increased risk of developing colon cancer and a 30% increased risk of dying because of it compared with patients without diabetes. Data exist that modifiable lifestyle issues, diet and activity, are increasingly associated with the risk of colorectal cancer development, perhaps more so than any other malignancy. Wow, I'm blown away by this stuff. And you know, I know we're talking about, there's a lot of medical terms in here. I get it. There's a lot of things in here like, what is neoplasm? Well, look it up. You have a phone in your hand or you have a screen in front of you. Type in, ask Google, what is a neoplasm? I could tell you, but I'm going to let you look it up. And I want you to know that if there's something here you don't understand, if you feel confused, don't let that happen to you. If you're interested and you want to take this conversation a little bit further, do something. Remember, confused people do nothing. Don't be confused. Take some action. To get something better, you have to do something better. Now, prostate cancer is the most commonly diagnosed malignancy in men, affecting 1.6 million worldwide and resulting in the death of nearly 370,000 in 2015. In the U.S., nearly 150,000 men received a diagnosis of prostate cancer in 2016, and close to 40,000 of them will die of this cancer. Somewhat alarming is a recent report that the incidence of metastatic prostate cancer has increased by 72% since 2004. Of particular concern is that the largest increase in new cases was in the age range of 55 to 69 years old, ironically the same group most likely to benefit from early treatment. If this increase is, as some postulate, caused by a more aggressive presentation of the disease, then the importance of lifestyle changes may further increase in relevancy. As with many other malignancies, diet and obesity contribute to chronic inflammatory processes that lead to disease aggressiveness. Furthermore, obesity has been implicated in not only the development but also the progression of prostate cancer. Prostate cancer patients are often advised to make lifestyle changes. Such changes could be beneficial but need further verification. In one study, changes in prostate-specific antigen levels were monitored in a small group of patients. The experimental group was subjected to an intensive lifestyle intervention program, which included a vegan diet, soy protein, supplemental vitamins E and C, selenium, exercise, 30 minutes of walking, 6 days a week, and support group stress management programs for 1 hour per week. Prostate-specific antigen levels decreased 4% in the experimental group and increased 6% in the control group. In other words, the control group didn't have these things. They weren't asked to make a vegan lifestyle, soy protein, vitamin E and C, exercise, selenium, all that. The control group went up and the experimental group went down. In addition, blood taken from both groups demonstrated that the serum of the experimental group inhibited growth of prostate cancer cells nearly eightfold more intensively than the serum of the control group. Furthermore, these comprehensive nutrition and lifestyle changes have been shown to downregulate, in other words, turn off, prostate gene expression in men after a diagnosis of early stage prostate cancer. The incidence and mortality of prostate cancer appear to be associated with a Western lifestyle, and a strong corollary relationship has been noted with the intake of animal foods. Men in developing countries who drift toward a Western-oriented lifestyle experience an increased incidence of prostate cancer. Furthermore, migration studies have demonstrated that those populations that live in low cancer risk geographic areas assume Western rates of cancer within 1 to 2 decades of immigration to the West. This observation is not limited to prostate cancer, but involves the development of other malignancies as well. In fact, in the China study, something that's really interesting, what Dr. Campbell and Dr. Campbell, that's written by two doctors, Campbell, father and son, the beauty of what they were able to do with the China study is They really studied people in the rural areas of China. And because the Chinese people at the time this work was done in the 80s were mostly 90% of them had grown up, lived, and died, really, grown up, lived, and died within the same province, right? Like, so people weren't just like moving off to the cities. Like, we all sort of, you know, oh yeah, I have six kids. One lives in Albuquerque, the other's up in Boston. I've got two over in Alaska, right? Like, we move. That's what Americans do. We're like, yeah, I'm going to move. Well, the Chinese people didn't do that. So one of the things they were able to do is to look at people's lifestyle kind of from a beginning to an end. I mean, if you're living in the Hunan province, you're going to eat what they eat in the Hunan province. And if you did that for 90 years until you died, there was a pretty consistent record there of your lifestyle. So they did all these amazing interventions where they like took blood work from people. They sat with them in their houses for days and they tracked everything they ate. And what they were able to do is find that diseases were geographically concentrated in certain areas. So one mountainous community might have a high incidence of prostate cancer, and another mountainous community might have a high incidence of breast cancer, and then a coastal community might have a whole lot of diabetes. Well, what they were able to do is look at those graphs and charts, the heat maps of where the diseases were, and then they overlaid that with lifestyle factors, which was amazing. And because the Chinese people hadn't moved much and they were genetically homogenous. In other words, there were 90% similarities, 87 to 97% similarities in the Chinese people. They weren't a widely divergent group. It wasn't like here in America where we're the melting pot, right? Like you ask people, oh, what's your background? Well, I'm 17% Asian, and which I am, I'm 17% Asian. I've had the work done on me and it's kind of fun. Tells me why I love to go to Thai food all the time and eat anything stir fried. And oh man, I love Asian food. But there's also Norwegian and Northern European and this and that. But Chinese people are Chinese people, like people that were studied in this. But what they discovered was if a person living in China, in one of those little provinces, moved to the U.S., even though for all their life and their whole entire family and group of people, everybody there, low incidence of prostate cancer, boom, they moved to the U.S. And then all of a sudden, within 10 years, oh, you have prostate cancer. Why? Because they started eating what we eat, highly processed, super high amounts of saturated fats and animal protein. And I got to tell you, there's an amazing couple chapters in here about fat, because we often talk about, well, it's about the saturated fat, or, you know, where's the fat coming from? It's really about the animal proteins. It's really, really about the animal proteins. The fat is bad stuff. It is, no doubt about it, but it's really about the animal proteins. All right. So I know we don't have tons of time left, but I'm going to read this section on breast cancer, and then we'll probably look at the daily dietary recommendations, and that's about all we're going to have time for today. Thank you again for being here with us on KCIW 100.7 FM on your radio dial. I'm Misty Young. This is the Ocean Mist Power Hour. We talk about all kinds of wild and crazy and fun things, and this is one of those things, you know, nutrition and health and how you can have a happier life. You know, I started out the beginning of this session telling all the gratitude, and I didn't even touch the very, I just surface touched. It was butterfly touches of my gratitude. I am so incredibly thankful. So back to the article, breast cancer. The most common malignancy among women in 2016 was breast cancer, affecting 2.4 million women worldwide and taking the lives of more than 520,000. In 2017, nearly 250,000 women will receive a diagnosis of breast cancer, and more than 40,000 will die in the U.S. alone. Breast cancer is the most feared disease by many women, yet heart disease is still the leading cause of death in women in the U.S. And interestingly, less than 50% of women are aware that heart disease is the leading cause of death. As with previously addressed malignancies, breast cancer can be attributed in part to a lifestyle fueled by a poor diet that often results in obesity. Sinicrope and Dannenberg addressed this topic in a recent publication. Now remember, if you go look at this article, it's in the permanentejournal.org. Lifestyle Medicine is the name of the article. And you can look at every single one of these references. Don't feel like I'm just going to give you information and not let you take it to the next level. You surely can. It says here that obesity leads to insulin resistance, resulting in elevated blood levels of insulin and insulin-like growth factor, IGF, and a decrease in sex hormone-binding globulin. Consequently, the availability of estradiol increases, which may fuel the development and aggressiveness of breast cancers. Fatty tissues, adipocytes, have been demonstrated to be an independent endocrinogenic organ capable of manufacturing and storing estrogenic compounds that contribute to multiple malignancies. That's a weird word. Endocrinogenic. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I'm just kind of talking about that out loud for you because, you know, if I'm having a hard time reading these words, maybe you're having a hard time listening to them too. Importantly, fatty tissues also store a dozen or more inflammatory proteins that promote carcinogenesis. That's the development of carcinogens, or cancer, actually. In a recent study, low-dose aspirin was shown to reduce inflammation, resulting in a lower incidence of breast cancer. Interesting. Not only is obesity a risk factor for breast cancer development, it is an independent prognostic factor for distant metastases and an increased risk of death. Comorbidities also have a role in oncogenesis. Patients with diabetes have a 23% increased risk of breast cancer developing and a 38% increased risk of dying of the disease compared with patients without diabetes. A substantial proportion of breast cancer patients are both obese and sedentary, emphasizing the need for lifestyle interventions that may improve prognosis and ultimate outcomes. Understanding of breast cancer and the influence of dietary consumption patterns has recently advanced. Dietary recommendations, including an increase in fiber intake, have been made to aid in the prevention of this cancer. Recently, the human estrobiome, that's an interesting term, has been discovered as the set of gut bacterial genes that metabolize estrogen. Wow! Dysbiosis of the gastrointestinal tract is involved in the recycling of estrogen through the enteropathic circulation, increasing its potency, which may further fuel the development of breast cancer. Hang in there. If there's a lot of words in here you don't understand, here's what you do understand, and I know you get this. Your lifestyle makes a difference in your outcome. I know you get that, even if we don't understand what the, let's pick a word here, enterohepatic. Ooh, enterohepatic. That's the actual word that has something to do with something entering into the liver. Look, if you don't get a lot of these words, I don't understand them all either. You know I'm not a doctor and I'm not a scientist. I'm delivering this information to you. Here's what you do know. You do know that you're not going to drink kerosene. You wouldn't do that. It's poison. Well, guess what? Maybe it's just possible that cow milk is the same as kerosene entering your body. Poison, poison, poison. That's right, I'm adding a little bit of hip-hop in here. Poison, poison. That's what I have to say about cow milk. The American Institute for Cancer Research reported in 2014 from worldwide data that diet, physical activity, and weight control are major contributors to long-term survival after a diagnosis of breast cancer. Furthermore, a 2011 meta-analysis of post-diagnosis exercise in patients with breast cancer involving more than 12,000 patients demonstrated a 34% decrease in risk of death caused by breast cancer, a 24% decrease in recurrence, and a 41% decrease in the risk of all-cause mortality. This conclusion is the result of the review of 67 published articles addressing lifestyle changes as they relate to the reduction of breast cancer recurrence. Additional studies have documented that physical activity not only increases survival and decreases recurrence, but also improves overall quality of life in patients with breast cancer and in patients with colon cancer. Another study followed nearly 1,500 women diagnosed with early-stage breast cancer. These patients were followed for up to 9 years and demonstrated a 50% decreased death rate in those who adhered to a high fruit and vegetable intake, 5 servings a day, and a regular physical activity regimen, 30 minutes 5 times a week, compared with those who did not. Although the exact mechanism of the action of exercise and its impact on cancer recurrence remains elusive, some have pointed to the possibility that exercise may affect the inflammatory response of the body, resulting in a decreased rate of recurrence. Regular exercise may also have a protective role in the initial development of breast cancer. Wow, this is amazing. Now, I'm going to give you very quickly the daily dietary recommendations. These are coming from this same article. The article is called Lifestyle Medicine, a brief review of its dramatic impact on health and survival. It's written by, as you already know, almost two dozen docs. Their dietary recommendations are to decrease substantially or eliminate low nutrient and or high calorie, right? So they want you to get rid of these inflammatory things: meat, beef, pork, lamb, chicken, turkey, seafood, processed meats, salami, bologna, ham, turkey, chicken, animal dairy, milk, cheese, yogurt, kefir, sour cream, cottage cheese, butter, sugar substitutes and refined sugars, aspartame, high fructose corn syrup, processed foods, refined grains, white bread, cookies, fried potato chips, and soft drinks and alcohol. Those are all the things they want you to get rid of. And here's the things they want you to increase or consume heavily. And they call these things the anti-inflammatory effects. Ready? High nutrient, low calorie, leafy greens, vegetables, cruciferous, squash, garlic, mushrooms, fruits, berries, bananas, pomegranates, legumes, green beans, lentils, soybeans, sugar snap peas, whole grains, quinoa, wheat, oat, rice, pasta, barley, corn, seeds, flax, chia, pumpkin, sesame, plant-based dairy, soy, almond, rice milk, and high nutrient, high fat, limited consumption. They want you to do limited consumption of nuts, walnuts, pecans, almonds, etc. So that's all we're going to have time for today. We got to wrap it up. I'm going to tell you that I can't wrap this up. I have to finish this article for you, and it's probably going to be two whole more sessions because this is a long piece of medical information. And I want to thank you for being here on KCIW. I want to thank you for sharing with me your time on the Ocean Mist Power Hour. I want you to remember that confused people do nothing, and there's no reason for you to be confused. And if there's something here that's unclear to you, go get the article, the Permanente Journal, and then type in lifestyle medicine and read this article for yourself. There might be words in there that you don't know what they mean. I can't tell you I know exactly what every word means either. But what I can tell you is, if I want something to be different, then I have to do something different. And if you know that to be true in your life too, then it's time to maybe try to do something different. Thank you again for being here on the Ocean Mist Power Hour. We're broadcasting at KCIW 100.7 FM on your radio dial out of Brookings Harbor, Oregon, the gateway of the Great Pacific Northwest, about as far west as you can get in the continental U.S. This is the home of daffodils in December, flowers all year round, and the nicest people you'll ever meet. Where the mountains and the redwoods meet the sea, Harbor Brookings is home to me. Thanks again for being here on the Ocean Mist Power Hour.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program. The information provided is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice. Always seek the advice of your personal physician or other qualified healthcare professional before changing your healthcare treatment, diet, or lifestyle.